Rayford loved her youth and her eagerness to commit to a cause that to her was only hours old. "And what is it you call this period?" she asked. "The Tribulation," Bruce said. "So your little group inside the group, a sort of Green Berets, would be your Tribulation Force."
"Tribulation Force," Bruce said, looking at Rayford and rising to scribble it on his flip chart. "I like it. Make no mistake, it won't be fun. It would be the most dangerous cause a person could ever join. We would study, prepare, and speak out. When it becomes obvious who the Antichrist is, the false prophet, the evil, counterfeit religion, we'll have to oppose them, speak out against them. We would be targeted. Christians content to hide in basements with their Bibles might escape everything but earthquakes and wars, but we will be vulnerable to everything. There will come a time, Chloe, that followers of Antichrist will be required to bear the sign of the beast. There are all kinds of theories on what form that might take, from a tattoo to a stamp on the forehead that might be detected only under infrared light. But obviously, we would refuse to bear that mark. That very act of defiance will be a mark in itself. We will be the naked ones, the ones devoid of the protection of belonging to the majority. You still want to be part of the Tribulation Force?" Rayford nodded and smiled at his daughter's firm reply. "I wouldn't miss it." 2 hours after the Steeles had left, Buck Williams parked his rental car in front of New Hope Village Church in Mount Prospect, Illinois. He had a sense of destiny tinged with fear. Who would this Bruce Barnes be? What would he look like? And would he be able to detect a non-Christian at a glance? Buck sat in the car, his head in his hands. He was too analytical, he knew, to make a rash decision. Even his leaving home years before to pursue an education and become a journalist had been plotted for years. To his family it came like a thunderbolt, but to young Cameron Williams it was a logical next step, a part of his long-range plan. Where Buck sat now was not part of any plan. Nothing that had happened since that ill-fated flight to Heathrow had fit into any predefined pattern for him. He had always liked the serendipity of life, but he processed it through a grid of logic, attacked it from a perspective of order. The firestorm of Israel had jarred him, but even then he had been acting from a standpoint of order. He had a career, a position, a role. He had been in Israel on assignment, and though he hadn't expected to become a war correspondent overnight, he had been prepared by the way he had ordered his life. But nothing had prepared him for the disappearances or for the violent deaths of his friends. While he should have been prepared for this promotion, that hadn't been part of his plan either. Now this theory article was bringing him close to flames he had never known were burning in his soul. He felt alone, exposed, vulnerable. And yet this meeting with Bruce Barnes had been his idea. Sure, the airline pilot had suggested it, but Buck could have ignored him without remorse. This trip had not been about getting in a few extra hours with the beautiful Chloe, and the Chicago Bureau could have waited. He was here, he knew, for this meeting. Buck felt a bone weariness as he headed for the church. It was a pleasant surprise to find that Bruce Barnes was someone near Buck's own age. He seemed bright and earnest, having that same authority and passion Rayford Steele exhibited. It had been a long time since Buck had been in a church. This one seemed innocuous enough, fairly new and modern, neat and efficient. He and the young pastor met in a modest office. "Your friends the Steeles told me you might call," Barnes said. Buck was struck by his honesty. In the world in which Buck moved, he might have kept that information to himself, that edge. But he realized that the pastor had no interest in an edge. There was nothing to hide here. In essence, Buck was looking for information, and Bruce was interested in providing it. "I want to tell you right off," Bruce said.
that I'm aware of your work and respect your talent. But to be frank, I no longer have time for the pleasantries and small talk that used to characterize my work. We live in perilous times. I have a message and an answer for people genuinely seeking. I tell everyone in advance that I have quit apologizing for what I'm going to say. If there's a ground rule you can live with, I have all the time you need. Well, sir, Buck said, nearly staggered by the emotion and humility he heard in his own voice, I appreciate that. I don't know how long I'll need, because I'm not here on business. It might have made sense to get a pastor's view for my story, but people can guess what pastors think, especially based on the other people I'm quoting. Like Captain Steele, Buck nodded. I'm here for myself, and I have to tell you frankly, I don't know where I am on this. Not that long ago, I would never have set foot in a place like this, or dreamed anything intellectually worthwhile could come out of here. I know that wasn't exactly journalistically fair of me, but as long as you're being honest, I will be too. I was impressed with Captain Steele. That's one smart guy, a good thinker, and he's into this. You seem like a bright person, and I don't know. I'm listening, that's all I'll say. Bruce began by telling Buck his life story, being raised in a Christian home, going to Bible college, marrying a Christian, becoming a pastor, the whole thing. He clarified that he knew the story of Christ and the way of forgiveness and a relationship with God. I thought I had the best of both worlds, but the scripture is clear that you can't serve two masters. You can't have it both ways. I discovered that truth in the severest way. And he told of losing his family and friends, everyone dear to him. He wept as he spoke. The pain is every bit as great today as it was when it happened, he said. Then Bruce outlined, as Rayford had done, the plan of salvation from beginning to end. Buck grew nervous, anxious. He wanted a break. He interrupted and asked if Bruce wanted to know a little more about him. Sure, Bruce said. Buck told of his own history, concentrating most on the Russia-Israel conflict and the roughly 14 months since. I can see, Bruce said at last, that God is trying to get your attention. Well, he's got it, Buck said. I just have to warn you, I'm not an easy sell. All this is interesting and sounds more plausible than ever, but it's just not me to jump into something. Nobody can force you or badger you into this, Mr. Williams, but I must also say again that we live in perilous times. We don't know how much pondering time we have. You sound like Chloe Steele. And she sounds like her father, Bruce said, smiling. And he, I guess, sounds like you. I can see why you all consider this so urgent, but like I say, I understand, Bruce said. If you have the time right now, let me take a different tack. I know you're a bright guy, so you might as well have all the information you need before you leave here. Buck breathed easier. He had feared Bruce was about to pop the question, pushing him to pray the prayer both Rayford Steele and Chloe had talked about. He accepted that that would be part of it, that it would signal the transaction and start his relationship with God, someone he had never before really spoken to. But he wasn't ready. At least he didn't think he was, and he would not be pushed. I don't have to be back in New York until Monday morning, he said, so I'll take as much time tonight as you'll give me. I don't mean to be morbid, Mr. Williams, but I have no family responsibilities anymore. I have a core group meeting tomorrow and church Sunday. You're welcome to attend, but I have enough energy to go to midnight if you do. I'm all yours. Bruce spent the next several hours giving Buck a crash course in prophecy and the end times. Buck had heard much of the information about the rapture and the two witnesses, and he had picked up snippets about the Antichrist. But when Bruce got to the parts about the great one-world religion that would spring up, the lying so-called peacemaker who would bring bloodshed through war, the Antichrist who would divide the world into 10 kingdoms, Buck's blood ran cold. He fell silent, no longer peppering Bruce with questions or comments. He scribbled notes as fast as he could. Did he dare tell this unpretentious man that he believed Nikolai Carpathia could be the very man the scriptures talked about? Could all this be coincidental? His fingers began to shake when Bruce told of the prediction of a 7-year pact between Antichrist and Israel, of the rebuilding of the temple, and even of Babylon becoming headquarters for a new world order. Finally, as midnight came, Buck was overcome. He felt a terrible fear deep in his gut. Bruce Barnes could have had no knowledge whatever of the plans of Nikolai Carpathia before they had been announced on the news that afternoon. At one point he thought of accusing Bruce of having based everything he was saying on the CNN report he had heard and seen, but even if he had, here it was in black and white in the Bible. "Did you see the news today?" Buck asked. "Not today," Bruce said. "I've been in meetings since noon and grabbed a bite just before you got here." Buck told him what had happened at the UN. Bruce paled. "That's why we've been hearing all those clicking sounds on my answering machine," Bruce said. "I turned the ringer off on the phone, so the only way you can tell when a call comes in is by the clicking on the answering machine. People are calling to let me know. They do that a lot. We talk about what the Bible says may happen, and when it does, people check in." "You think Carpathia is this Antichrist?" "I don't see how I could come to any other conclusion." "But I really believed in the guy." "Why not? Most of us did. Self-effacing, interested in the welfare of the people, humble, not looking for power or leadership. But the Antichrist is a deceiver, and he has the power to control men's minds. He can make people see lies as truth." Buck told Bruce of his invitation to the pre-press conference meeting. "You must not go," Bruce said. "I can't not go," Buck said. "This is the opportunity of a lifetime." "I'm sorry," Bruce said. "I have no authority over you, but let me plead with you, warn you about what happens next. The Antichrist will solidify his power with a show of strength." "He already has." "Yes, but it appears that all these long-range agreements he has been conceded will take months or years to effect. Now he has to show some potency. What might he do to entrench himself so solidly that no one can oppose him?" "I don't know." "He undoubtedly has ulterior motives for wanting you there." "I'm no good to him." "You would be if he controlled you." "But he doesn't. If he is the evil one the Bible speaks of, there is little he does not have the power to do. I warn you not to go there without protection." "A bodyguard?" "At least. But if Carpathia is the Antichrist, do you want to face him without God?" Buck was taken aback. This conversation was bizarre enough without wondering if Bruce was using any means necessary to get him to convert. No doubt it had been a sincere and logical question, yet Buck felt pressured. "I see what you mean," he said slowly, "but I don't think I'm going to get hypnotized or anything." "Mr. Williams, you have to do what you have to do, but I'm pleading with you. If you go into that meeting without God in your life, you will be in mortal and spiritual danger." He told Buck about his conversation with the Steels and how they had collectively come up with the idea of a tribulation force. "It's a band of serious-minded people who will boldly oppose the Antichrist. I just didn't expect that his identity would become so obvious so soon." The tribulation force stirred something deep within Buck. It took him back to his earliest days as a writer, when he believed he had the power to change the world. He would stay up all hours of the night plotting with his colleagues how they would have the courage and the audacity to stand up to oppression, to big government, to bigotry. He had lost that fire and verve over the years as he won accolades for his writing. He still wanted to do the right things.
but he had lost the passion of the all-for-one and one-for-all philosophy as his talent and celebrity began to outstrip those same colleagues. The idealist, the maverick in him, gravitated toward such ideas, but he caught himself before he talked himself into becoming a believer in Christ just because of an exciting little club he could join. "Do you think I could sit in on your core group meeting tomorrow?" he asked. "I'm afraid not," Bruce said. "I think you'd find it interesting, and I personally believe it would help convince you, but it's limited to our leadership team. Truth is, I'll be going over with them tomorrow what you and I are talking about tonight, so it would be a rerun for you anyway." "And church Sunday?" "You're very welcome, but I must say it's going to be the same theme I use every Sunday. You've heard it from Ray Steele, and you've heard it from me. If hearing it one more time would help, then come on out and see how many seekers and finders there are. If it's anything like the last two Sundays, it will be standing room only." Buck stood and stretched. He had kept Bruce long past midnight, and he apologized. "No need," Bruce said. "This is what I do." "Do you know where I can get a Bible?" "I've got one you can have," Bruce said. The next day, the core group enthusiastically and emotionally welcomed its newest member, Chloe Steele. They spent much of the day studying the news and trying to determine the likelihood of Nikolai Carpathia's being the Antichrist. No one could argue otherwise. Bruce told the story of Buck Williams without using his name or mentioning his connection with Rayford and Chloe. Chloe cried silently as the group prayed for his safety and for his soul. Chapter 24. Buck spent Saturday holed up in the otherwise empty Chicago bureau office, getting a head start on his article on the theory behind the disappearances. His mind continually swirled, forcing him to think about Carpathia and what he would say in that piece about how the man seemed to be a perfect parallel to biblical prophecy. Fortunately, he could wait on writing that until after the big day, Monday. Around lunchtime, Buck reached Steve Plank at the Plaza Hotel in New York. "I'll be there Monday morning," he said, "but I'm not inviting Hattie Durham." "Why not? It's a small request, friend to friend." "You to me?" "Nick to you." "So now it's Nick, is it? Well, he and I are not close enough for that familiarity, and I don't provide female companionship even to my friends." "Not even for me?" "If I knew you would treat her with respect, Steve, I'd set you up with Hattie." "You're really not going to do this for Carpathia?"
"No."
"Am I uninvited?"
"I'm not going to tell him."
"How are you going to explain it when she doesn't show?"
"I'll ask her myself, Buck, you prude."
Buck didn't say he would warn Hattie not to go. He asked Steve if he could get one more exclusive with Carpathia before starting his cover story on him.
"I'll see what I can do, but you can't even do a small favor and you want another break?"
"He likes me, you said. You know I'm going to do the complete piece on the guy. He needs this."
"If you watched TV yesterday, you know he doesn't need anything. We need him."
"Do we? Have you run into any schools of thought that link him to end times events in the Bible?" Steve Plank did not respond.
"Steve?"
"I'm here."
"Well, have you? Anybody that thinks he might fill the bill for one of the villains of the Book of Revelation?"
Steve said nothing.
"Hello, Steve."
"I'm still here."
"Come on, old buddy. You're the press secretary. You know all. How's he going to respond if I hit him with that?"
Steve was still silent.
"Don't do this to me, Steve. I'm not saying that's where I am or that anybody who knows anything or who matters thinks that way. I'm doing the piece on what was behind the disappearances, and you know that takes me into all kinds of religious realms. Nobody anywhere has drawn any parallels here."
This time, when Steve said nothing, Buck merely looked at his watch, determined to wait him out. About 20 seconds after a loud silence, Steve spoke softly.
Buck, I have a two-word answer for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Staten Island, are you telling me that... Don't say the name, Buck. You never know who's listening. So you're threatening me with... I'm not threatening. I'm warning. Let me say I'm cautioning you.
And let me remind you, Steve, that I don't warn well. You remember that, don't you? From ages ago, when we worked together, and you thought I was the toughest bird dog you'd ever sent on a story?
Just don't go sniffing the wrong briar patch, Buck.
Let me ask you this then, Steve.
Careful, please.
You want to talk to me on another line?
No, Buck, I just want you to be careful what you say, so I can be too.
Buck began scribbling furiously on a yellow pad. Fair enough, he said, writing, Carpathia or Stonegal responsible for Eric Miller. What I want to know is this. If you think I should stay off the ferry, is it because of the guy behind the wheel or because of the guy who supplies his fuel?
The latter, Steve said without hesitation.
Buck circled Stonegal. Then you don't think the guy behind the wheel is even aware of what the fuel distributor does in his behalf?
Correct.
So if someone got too close to the pilot might be protected and not even know it?
Correct.
But if he found out about it?
He'd deal with it.
That's what I expect to see soon.
I can't comment on that.
Can you tell me who you really work for?
I work for who it appears to you I work for.
What in the world did that mean? Carpathia or Stonegal? How could he get Steve to say, on a phone from within the plaza that might be bugged, you work for the Romanian businessman?
Of course.
Buck nearly kicked himself. That could be either Carpathia or Stonegal. You do? He said, hoping for more.
My boss moves mountains, doesn't he? Steve said.
He sure does, Buck said, circling Carpathia this time. You must be pleased with everything going on these days.
I am.
Buck scribbled, Carpathia, end times, Antichrist. And you're telling me straight up that the other issue I raised is dangerous, but also hogwash.
Total roll in the muck.
And I shouldn't even broach the subject with him, in spite of the fact that I'm a writer who covers all the bases and asks the tough questions.
If I thought you would consider mentioning it, I would not encourage the interview or the story.
Boy, it didn't take long for you to become a company man. After the core group meeting, Rayford Steele talked privately with Bruce Barnes and was updated on the meeting with Buck. I can't discuss the private matters, Bruce said, but only one thing stands in the way of my being convinced that this Carpathia guy is the Antichrist. I can't make it compute geographically. Almost every End Times writer I respect believes the Antichrist will come out of Western Europe, maybe Greece or Italy or Turkey. Rayford didn't know what to make of that. You notice Carpathia doesn't look Romanian? Aren't they mostly dark?
Yeah.
Let me call Mr. Williams. He gave me a number. I wonder how much more he knows about Carpathia. Bruce dialed and put Buck on the speakerphone. Ray Steele is with me.
Hey, Captain, Buck said.
We're just doing some studying here, Bruce said, and we've hit a snag. He told Buck what they had found and asked for more information. Well, he comes from a town, one of the larger university towns, called Cluj, and...
Oh, he does?
I guess I thought he was from a mountainous region, you know, because of his name.
His name? Buck repeated, doodling it on his legal pad.
You know, being named after the Carpathian Mountains and all. Or does that name mean something else over there?
Buck sat up straight and it hit him. Steve had been trying to tell him he worked for Stonegal and not Carpathia. And of course, all the new UN delegates would feel beholden to Stonegal because he had introduced them to Carpathia. Maybe Stonegal was the Antichrist. Where had his lineage begun? Well, Buck said, trying to concentrate, maybe he was named after the mountains, but he was born in Cluj, and his ancestry way back is Roman. That accounts for the blonde hair and blue eyes.
Bruce thanked him and asked if he would see Buck in church the next day. Rayford thought Buck sounded distracted and noncommittal.
I haven't ruled it out, Buck said.
Yes, Buck thought, hanging up. I'll be there all right. He wanted every last bit of input before he went to New York to write a story that could cost him his career and maybe his life. He didn't know the truth, but he had never backed off from looking for it, and he wouldn't begin now. He phoned Hattie Durham.
Hattie, he said, you're going to get a call inviting you to New York.
I already did.
They wanted me to ask you, but I told them to do it themselves.
They did.
They want you to see Carpathia again, provide him some companionship next week if you're free.
I know, and I am, and I will.
I'm advising you not to do it, she laughed.
Right, I'm going to turn down a date with the most powerful man in the world? I don't think so.
That would be my advice.
Whatever for?
Because you don't strike me as that kind of girl.
First, I'm not a girl. I'm almost as old as you are, and I don't need a parent or a legal guardian.
I'm talking as a friend.
You're not my friend, Buck. It was obvious you didn't even like me. I tried to shove you off onto Rayford Steele's little girl, and I'm not sure you even had the brains to pick up on that.
Hattie, maybe I don't know you, but you don't seem the type who would allow herself to be taken advantage of by a stranger.
You're pretty much a stranger, and you're trying to tell me what to do.
Well, are you that kind of a person? By not passing along the invitation, was I protecting you from something you might enjoy?
You'd better believe it.
I can't talk you out of it.
You can't even try, she said, and she hung up.
Buck shook his head and leaned back in his chair, holding the yellow pad in front of him.
My boss moves mountains, Steve had said. Carpathia is a mountain. Stonegal is the mover and shaker behind him. Steve thinks he's really wired in deep. He's not only press secretary to the man Hattie Durham correctly called the most powerful man on earth, but Steve is also actually in league with the man behind the man.
Buck wondered what Rayford and Chloe would do if they knew Hattie had been invited to New York to be Carpathia's companion for a few days. In the end, he decided it was none of his or their business.
Rayford and Chloe watched for Buck until the last minute the next morning, but they could no longer save a seat for him when the sanctuary in the balcony filled. When Bruce began his message, Chloe nudged her father and pointed out the window, down onto the walk before the front door. There, in a small crowd listening to an external speaker, was Buck. Rayford raised a celebratory fist and whispered to Chloe, "Wonder what you're gonna pray for this morning?" Bruce played the former pastor's videotape, told his own story again, talked briefly about prophecy, invited people to receive Christ, and then opened the microphone for personal accounts. As had happened the previous 2 weeks, people streamed forward and stood in line until well after 1 in the afternoon, eager to tell how they had now finally trusted Christ. Chloe told her father she had wanted to be first, as he had been, but by the time she made her way down from the last row of the balcony, she was one of the last. She told her story, including the sign she believed God had given her in the form of a friend who sat beside her on the flight home. Rayford knew she couldn't see Buck over the crowd, and Rayford couldn't either. When the meeting was over, Rayford and Chloe went outside to find Buck, but he was gone. They went for lunch with Bruce, and when they got home, Chloe found a note from Buck on the front door. "It isn't that I didn't want to say goodbye, but I don't. I'll be back for bureau business, and maybe just to see you, if you'll allow it. I've got a lot to think about right now, as you know, and frankly I don't want my attraction to you to get in the way of that thinking. And it would. You are a lovely person, Chloe, and I was moved to tears by your story. You had told me before, but to hear it in that place and in that circumstance this morning was beautiful. Would you do something I have never asked anyone to do for me ever before? Would you pray for me? I will call you or see you soon. I promise. Buck. Buck felt more alone than ever on the flight home. He was in coach on a full plane, but he knew no one. He read several sections from the Bible Bruce had given him and had marked for him, prompting the woman next to him to ask questions. He answered in such a way that she could tell he was not in the mood for conversation. He didn't want to be rude, but neither did he want to mislead anyone with his limited knowledge. Sleep was no easier for him that night, though he refused to allow himself to pace. He was going into a meeting in the morning that he had been warned to stay away from. Bruce Barnes had sounded convinced that if Nikolai Carpathia were the Antichrist, Buck ran the danger of being mentally overcome, brainwashed, hypnotized, or worse. As he wearily showered and dressed in the morning, Buck concluded he had come a long way from thinking that the religious angle was on the fringe. He had gone from bemused puzzlement at people thinking their loved ones had flown to heaven to believing that much of what was happening had been foretold in the Bible. He was no longer wondering or doubting, he told himself. There was no other explanation for the two witnesses in Jerusalem, nor for the disappearances. And the furthest stretch of all, this business of an Antichrist who deceives so many, well, in Buck's mind, it was no longer an issue of whether it was literal or true. He was long past that. He had already progressed to trying to decide who the Antichrist was, Carpathia or Stonegal. Buck still leaned toward Stonegal. He slung his bag over his shoulder, tempted to take the gun from his bedside table, but knew he would never get it through the metal detectors. Anyway, he sensed, that was not the kind of protection he needed. What he needed was safekeeping for his mind and for his spirit. All the way to the United Nations, he agonized. Do I pray? He asked himself. Do I pray the prayer, as so many of those people said yesterday morning? Would I be doing it just to protect myself from the voodoo or the heebie-jeebies? He decided that becoming a believer could not be for the purpose of having a good luck charm. That would cheapen it. Surely God didn't work that way. And if Bruce Barnes could be believed, there was no more protection for believers now, during this period, than there was for anyone else. Huge numbers of people were going to die in the next 7 years, Christian or not. The question was, then, where would they be? There was only one reason to make the transaction, he decided. If he truly believed he could be forgiven and become one of God's people. God had become more than a force of nature or even a miracle worker to Buck, as God had been in the skies of Israel that night. It only made sense that if God made people, he would want to communicate with them, to connect with them. Buck entered the UN through hordes of reporters already setting up for the press conference. Limousines disgorged VIPs and crowds waited behind police barriers. Buck saw Stanton Bailey in a crowd near the door. What are you doing here? Buck said, realizing that in 5 years at Global, he had never seen Bailey outside the building. Just taking advantage of my position so I can be at this press conference. Proud you're going to be in the preliminary meeting. Be sure to remember everything. Thanks for transmitting your first draft of the theory piece. I know you've got a lot to do yet, but it's a terrific start. Gonna be a winner. Thanks, Buck said, and Bailey gave him a thumbs up. Buck realized that if that had happened a month before, he would have had to stifle a laugh at the corny old guy and would have told his colleagues what an idiot he worked for. Now he was strangely grateful for the encouragement. Bailey could have no hint what Buck was going through. Chloe Steele told her father of her plans to finally look into local college classes that Monday. And I was thinking, she said, about trying to get together with Hattie for lunch. I thought you didn't care for her, Rayford said.
I don't, but that's no excuse. She doesn't even know what's happened to me. She's not answering her phone. Any idea what her schedule is?
No, but I have to check my own. I'll see if she's flying today.
Rayford was told that not only was Hattie not scheduled that day, but also that she had requested a 30-day leave of absence.
That's odd, he told Chloe. Maybe she's got family troubles out west.
Maybe she's just taking some time off, Chloe said.
I'll call her later when I'm out.
What are you doing today?
I promised Bruce I'd come over and watch that Carpathia press conference later this morning.
What time's that?
10 our time, I think.
Well, if Hattie's not around for lunch, maybe I'll come by there.
Call us either way, hon, and we'll wait for you.
Buck's credentials were waiting for him at an information desk in the UN lobby. He was directed up to a private conference room off the suite of offices into which Nikolai Carpathia had already moved. Buck was at least 20 minutes early, but as he emerged from the elevator, he felt alone in a crowd. He saw no one he recognized as he began the long walk down a corridor of glass and steel leading to the room where he was to join Steve, the 10 designated ambassadors representing the permanent members of the new Security Council, several aides and advisors to the new Secretary General, including Rosenzweig, Stonegal, and various other members of his International Brotherhood of Financial Wizards, and, of course, Carpathia himself. Buck had always been energetic and confident. Others had noticed his purposeful stride on assignment. Now his gait was slow and unsure, and with every step his dread increased. The lights seemed to grow dimmer, the walls close in. His pulse increased and he had a sense of foreboding. The gripping fear reminded him of Israel when he believed he was going to die. Was he about to die? He couldn't imagine physical danger, yet clearly people who got in Carpathia's way, or in the way of Stonegal's plans for Carpathia, were now dead. Would he be just another in a line that stretched from Carpathia's business rival in Romania years before, through Dirk Burton and Alan Tompkins, to Eric Miller? No, what he feared, he knew, was not mortal danger. At least not now, not here. The closer he got to the conference room, the more he was repelled by a sense of evil, as if personified in that place. Almost without thinking, Buck found himself silently praying, God be with me, protect me. He felt no sense of relief. If anything, his thoughts of God made his recognition of evil more intense. He stopped 10 feet from the open door, and though he heard laughter and banter, he was nearly paralyzed by the atmosphere of blackness. He wanted to be anywhere but there, and yet he knew he couldn't retreat. This was the room in which the new leaders of the world congregated, and any sane person would have given anything to be there. Buck realized that what he really wanted was to have been there. He wished it were over, that he had seen this welcoming of new people, this brief speech of commitment or whatever it was to be, and was already writing about it. He tried to force himself toward the door, his thoughts deafening. Again he cried out to God, and he felt a coward, just like everyone else praying in the foxhole. He had ignored God for most of his life, and now when he felt the darkest anguish of his soul, he was figuratively on his knees. Yet he did not belong to God. Not yet. He knew that. God had answered Chloe's prayer for a sign before she had actually made the spiritual transaction. Why couldn't he have answered Buck's plea for calm and peace? Buck couldn't move until Steve Plank noticed him.
Buck, we're almost ready to begin. Come on in.
But Buck felt terrible, panicky. Steve, I need to run to the washroom. Do I have a minute? Steve glanced at his watch.
You've got 5, he said. And when you get back, you'll be right over there.
Steve pointed to a chair at one corner of a square block of tables. The journalist in Buck liked it. The perfect vantage point. His eyes darted to the nameplates in front of each spot.
he would face the main table where Carpathia had placed himself directly next to Stonegal, or had Stonegal been in charge of the seating. Next to Carpathia on the other side was a hastily hand-lettered nameplate with "Personal Assistant" written on it.
"Is that you?" Buck said.
"Nope."
Steve pointed at the corner opposite Buck's chair.
"Is Todd Cawthron here?" Buck said.
"Of course, right there in the light gray."
The Brit looked insignificant enough, but just beyond him were both Stonegal in charcoal and Carpathia, looking perfect in a black suit, white shirt, electric blue tie, and a gold stick pin. Buck shuddered at the sight of him, but Carpathia flashed a smile and waved him over. Buck signaled that he would be a minute.
"Now you've got only 4 minutes," Steve said. "Get going."
Buck put his bag in a corner next to a heavy-set, white-haired security guard, waved at his old friend Chaim Rosenzweig, and jogged to the washroom. He placed a janitor's bucket outside and locked the door. Buck backed up against the door, thrust his hands deep into his pockets, and dropped his chin to his chest, remembering Bruce's advice that he could talk to God the same way he talked to a friend.
"God," he said, "I need you, and not just for this meeting." And as he prayed, he believed. This was no experiment, no half-hearted attempt. He wasn't just hoping or trying something out. Buck knew he was talking to God himself. He admitted he needed God, that he knew he was as lost and as sinful as anyone. He didn't specifically pray the prayer he had heard others talk about, but when he finished, he had covered the same territory and the deal was done. Buck was not the type to go into anything lightly. As well as he knew anything, he knew there would be no turning back. Buck headed to the conference room more quickly this time, but strangely with no more confidence. He hadn't prayed for courage or peace this time. This prayer had been for his own soul. He hadn't known what he would feel, but he didn't expect this continued sense of dread. He didn't hesitate, however. When he walked in, everyone was in place. Carpathia, Stonegal, Todd Cawthron, Rosenzweig, Steve, and the financial powers and ambassadors. And one person Buck never expected, Hattie Durham. He stared, dumbfounded, as she took her place as Nikolai Carpathia's personal assistant. She winked at him, but he didn't acknowledge her. He hurried to his bag, nodded his thanks to the armed guard, and took only a notebook to his seat. While no special feeling had come with Buck's decision, he had a heightened sensitivity that something was happening here. There wasn't a doubt in his mind that the Antichrist of the Bible was in this room. And despite all he knew about Stonegal and what the man had engineered in England, and despite the ill feeling that came over him as he observed his smugness, Buck sensed the truest, deepest, darkest spirit of evil as he watched Carpathia take his place. Nikolai waited till everyone was seated, then rose with pseudo-dignity.
"Gentlemen and lady," he began, "this is an important moment. In a few minutes, we will greet the press and introduce those of you who shall be entrusted to lead the New World Order into a golden era. The global village has become united, and we face the greatest task and the greatest opportunity ever bestowed upon humankind."
Chapter 25. Nikolai Carpathia stepped out from his place at the table and went to each person individually. He greeted each by name, asking him to stand, shaking his hand, and kissing him on both cheeks. He skipped Hattie and started with the new British ambassador.
"Mr. Todd Cawthron," he said, "you shall be introduced as the ambassador of the great states of Britain, which now include much of Western and Eastern Europe. I welcome you to the team and confer upon you all the rights and privileges that go with your new station.
May you display to me and to those in your charge the consistency and wisdom that have brought you to this position.
Thank you, sir, Todd Cawthron said, and sat down as Carpathia moved on.
Todd Cawthron appeared shocked, as did several others, when Nikolai repeated the same sentiment, including precisely the same title, Ambassador of the Great States of Britain, to the British financier next to him. Todd Cawthron smiled tolerantly. Obviously, Carpathia had merely misspoken and should have referred to the man as one of his financial advisors, yet Buck had never seen Carpathia make such a slip. All around the four-sided table configuration, Carpathia went, one by one, saying exactly the same words to every ambassador, but customizing the litany to include the appropriate name and title. The recitation changed only slightly for his personal aides and advisors. When Carpathia got to Buck, he seemed to hesitate. Buck was slow on the draw, as if he wasn't sure he was to be included in this. Carpathia's warm smile welcomed him to stand. Buck was slightly off balance, trying to hold pen and notebook while shaking hands with the dramatic Carpathia. Nikolai's grip was firm and strong, and he maintained it throughout his recitation. He looked directly into Buck's eyes and spoke with quiet authority. "Mr. Williams," he said, "I welcome you to the team and confer upon you all the rights and privileges that go with your station." What was this? It was not what Buck expected, but it was so affirming, so flattering. He was not part of any team, and no rights or privileges should be conferred upon him. He shook his head slightly to signal that Carpathia was again confused, that he had apparently mistaken Buck for someone else. But Nikolai nodded slightly and smiled all the more, looking more deeply into Buck's eyes. He knew what he was doing. "May you display to me and to those in your charge the consistency and wisdom that have brought you to this position." Buck wanted to stand taller, to thank his mentor, his leader, the bestower of this honor. But no, it wasn't right. He didn't work for Carpathia. He was an independent journalist, not a supporter, not a follower, and certainly not an employee. His spirit resisted the temptation to say, "Thank you, sir," as everyone else had. He sensed and read the evil of the man, and it was all he could do to keep from pointing at him and calling him the Antichrist. He could almost hear himself screaming it at Carpathia. Nikolai still stared, still smiled, still gripped his hand. After an awkward silence, Buck heard chuckles, and Carpathia said, "You are most welcome, my slightly overcome and tongue-tied friend." The others laughed and applauded as Carpathia kissed him, but Buck did not smile. Neither did he thank the Secretary General. Bile rose in his throat. As Carpathia moved on, Buck realized what he had endured. Had he not belonged to God, he would have been swept into the web of this man of deceit. He could see it in the others' faces. They were honored beyond measure to be elevated to this tier of power and confidence, even Chaim Rosenzweig. Hattie seemed to melt in Carpathia's presence. Bruce Barnes had pleaded with Buck not to attend this meeting, and now Buck knew why. Had he come in unprepared, had he not been prayed for by Bruce and Chloe and probably Captain Steele, who knows whether he would have made his decision and his commitment to Christ in time to have the power to resist the lure of acceptance and power. Carpathia went through the ceremony with Steve, who gushed with pride. Nikolai eventually covered everyone in the room except the security guard, Hattie, and Jonathan Stonegal. He returned to his place and turned first to Hattie. "Miss Durham," he said, taking both her hands in his, "you shall be introduced as my personal assistant, having turned your back on a stellar career in the aviation industry. I welcome you to the team and confer upon you all the rights and privileges that go with your new station. May you display to me and to those in your charge the consistency and wisdom that have brought you to this position. Buck tried to catch Hattie's eye and shake his head, but she was zeroed in on her new boss. Was this Buck's fault? He had introduced her to Carpathia in the first place. Was she still reachable? Would he have access? He glanced around the room. Everyone stared with beatific smiles as Hattie breathed her heartfelt thanks and sat down again. Carpathia dramatically turned to Jonathan Stonegal. The latter smiled a knowing smile and stood regally. "Where do I begin, Jonathan, my friend?" Carpathia said. Stonegal dropped his head gratefully, and others murmured their agreement that this indeed was the man among men in the room. Carpathia took Stonegal's hand and began formally, "Mr. Stonegal, you have meant more to me than anyone on earth." Stonegal looked up and smiled, locking eyes with Carpathia. "I welcome you to the team," Carpathia said, "and confer upon you all the rights and privileges that go with your new station." Stonegal flinched, clearly not interested in being considered a part of the team, to be welcomed by the very man he had maneuvered into the presidency of Romania and now the secretary-generalship of the United Nations. His smile froze, then disappeared as Carpathia continued. "May you display to me and to those in your charge the consistency and wisdom that have brought you to this position." Rather than thanking Carpathia, Stonegal wrenched his hand away and glared at the younger man. Carpathia continued to gaze directly at him and spoke in quieter, warmer tones. "Mr. Stonegal, you may be seated."
"I will not," Stonegal said.
"Sir, I have been having a bit of sport at your expense because I knew you would understand." Stonegal reddened, clearly chagrined that he had overreacted.
"I beg your pardon, Nikolai," Stonegal said, forcing a smile, but obviously insulted at having been pushed into this shocking display.
"Please, my friend," Carpathia said. "Please be seated." "Gentlemen and lady, we have only a few minutes before we meet the media." Buck's eyes were still on Stonegal, who was seething. "I would like to present to you all just a bit of an object lesson in leadership, followership, and, may I say, chain of command. Mr. Scott M. Otterness, would you approach me, please?" The guard in the corner jerked in surprise and hurried to Carpathia. "One of my leadership techniques is my power of observation combined with a prodigious memory," Carpathia said. Buck couldn't take his eyes off Stonegal, who appeared to be considering revenge for having been embarrassed. He seemed ready to stand at any second and put Carpathia in his place. "Mr. Otterness here was surprised because we had not been introduced, had we, sir?"
"No, sir, Mr. Carpathia, sir, we had not."
"And yet I knew your name." The aging guard smiled and nodded. "I can also tell you the make and model and caliber of the weapon you carry on your hip. I will not look as you remove it and display it to this group." Buck watched in horror as Mr. Otterness unsnapped the leather strap holding the huge gun in his holster. He fumbled for it and held it with two hands so everyone but Carpathia, who had averted his eyes, could see it. Stonegal, still red-faced, appeared to be hyperventilating. "I observed, sir, that you were issued a .38 caliber police special with a 4-inch barrel, loaded with high-velocity hollow-point shells."
"You are correct," Otterness said gleefully.
"May I hold it, please?"
"Certainly, sir."
"Thank you. You may return to your post guarding Mr. Williams's bag, which contains a tape recorder, a cellular phone, and a computer. Am I correct, Cameron?"
Buck stared at him, refusing to answer. He heard Stonegal grumble about some sort of a parlor trick. Carpathia continued to look at Buck. Neither spoke.
"What is this?" Stonegal whispered. "You're acting like a child."
"I would like to tell you all what you are about to see," Carpathia said, and Buck felt anew the wash of evil in the room. He wanted more than anything to rub the goose flesh from his arms and run for his life, but he was frozen where he sat. The others seemed transfixed, but not troubled, as he and Stonegal were. "I am going to ask Mr. Stonegal to rise once more," Carpathia said, the large, ugly weapon safely at his side. "Jonathan, if you please." Stonegal sat staring at him. Carpathia smiled. "Jonathan, you know you can trust me. I love you for all you have meant to me, and I humbly ask you to assist me in this demonstration. I see part of my role as a teacher. You have said that yourself, and you have been my teacher for years." Stonegal stood, wary and rigid. "And now I am going to ask that we switch places." Stonegal swore.
"What is this?" he demanded.
"It will become clear quickly, and I will not need your help any more." To the others, Buck knew, it sounded as if Carpathia meant he would no longer need Stonegal's help for whatever this demonstration was. Just as he had sent the guard back to the corner unarmed, they had to assume he would thank Stonegal and let him return to his seat. Stonegal, with a disgusted frown, stepped out and traded places with Carpathia. That put Carpathia to Stonegal's right. On Stonegal's left sat Hattie, and beyond her, Mr. Todd Cawthron. "And now I am going to ask you to kneel, Jonathan," Carpathia said, his smile and his light tone having disappeared. To Buck, it seemed as if everyone in the room sucked in a breath and held it.
"That I will not do," Stonegal said.
"Yes, you will," Carpathia said quietly. "Do it now."
"No, sir, I will not," Stonegal said. "Have you lost your mind? I will not be humiliated. If you think you have risen to a position over me, you are mistaken."
Carpathia raised the .38, cocked it, and stuck the barrel into Stonegal's right ear. The older man at first jerked away, but Carpathia said, "Move again, and you are dead." Several others stood, including Rosenzweig, who cried plaintively, "Nikolai!" "Everyone be seated, please," Carpathia said, calm again. "Jonathan, on your knees." Painfully, the old man crouched, using Hattie's chair for support. He didn't face Carpathia or look at him. The gun was still in his ear. Hattie sat, pale and frozen. "My dear," Carpathia said, leaning toward her over Stonegal's head, "you will want to slide your chair back about 3 feet so as not to soil your outfit." She did not move. Stonegal began to whimper.
"Nikolai, why are you doing this? I am your friend. I am no threat."
"Begging does not become you, Jonathan. Please be quiet." "Hattie," he continued, looking directly into her eyes now, "stand and move your chair back and be seated. Hair, skin, skull tissue, and brain matter will mostly be absorbed by Mr. Todd Cawthron and the others next to him. I do not want anything to get on you." Hattie moved her chair back, her fingers trembling. Stonegal whined,
"No, Nikolai, no!"
Carpathia was in no hurry.
"I am going to kill Mr. Stonegal with a painless hollow-point round to the brain, which he will neither hear nor feel. The rest of us will experience some ringing in our ears. This will be instructive for you all.
You will understand cognitively that I am in charge, that I fear no man, and that no one can oppose me."
Mr. Otterness reached for his forehead as if dizzy and slumped to one knee. Buck considered a suicidal dive across the table for the gun, but he knew that others might die for his effort. He looked to Steve, who sat motionless as the others. Mr. Todd Cawthron shut his eyes and grimaced, as if expecting the report any second.
"When Mr. Stonegal is dead, I will tell you what you will remember. And lest anyone feel I have not been fair, let me not neglect to add that more than gore will wind up on Mr. Todd Cawthron's suit. A high-velocity bullet at this range will also kill him, which, as you know, Mr. Williams, is something I promised you I would deal with in due time."
Todd Cawthron opened his eyes at that news, and Buck heard himself shouting, "No!" as Carpathia pulled the trigger. The blast rattled the windows and even the door. Stonegal's head crashed into the toppling Todd Cawthron, and both were plainly dead before their entwined bodies reached the floor. Several chairs rolled back from the table as their occupants covered their heads in fear. Buck stared, mouth open, as Carpathia calmly placed the gun in Stonegal's limp right hand and twisted his finger around the trigger. Hattie shivered in her seat and appeared to try to admit a scream that would not come. Carpathia took the floor again. "What we have just witnessed here," he said kindly, as if speaking to children, "was a horrible, tragic end to two otherwise extravagantly productive lives. These men were two I respected and admired more than any others in the world. What compelled Mr. Stonegal to rush the guard, disarm him, take his own life and that of his British colleague, I do not know and may never fully understand." Buck fought within himself to keep his sanity, to maintain a clear mind, to, as his boss had told him on the way in, remember everything. Carpathia continued, his eyes moist. "All I can tell you is that Jonathan Stonegal told me as recently as at breakfast this morning that he felt personally responsible for two recent violent deaths in England, and that he could no longer live with the guilt. Honestly, I thought he was going to turn himself in to international authorities later today. And if he had not, I would have had to. How he conspired with Mr. Todd Cawthron, which led to the deaths in England, I do not know. But if he was responsible, then in a sad way, perhaps justice was meted out here today. We are all horrified and traumatized by having witnessed this. Who would not be? My first act as Secretary General would be to close the UN for the remainder of the day and to pronounce my regrettable benedictory obituary on the lives of two old friends. I trust you will all be able to deal with this unfortunate occurrence and that it will not forever hamper your ability to serve in your strategic roles. Thank you, gentlemen. While Ms. Durham phones security, I will be polling you for your version of what happened here." Hattie ran to the phone and could barely make herself understood in her hysteria.
"Come, quick! There's been a suicide and two men are dead. It was awful. Hurry!"
"Mr. Plank," Carpathia said.
"That was unbelievable,"
Steve said, and Buck knew he was dead serious.
"When Mr. Stonegal grabbed the gun, I thought he was going to kill us all."
Carpathia called on the United States ambassador.
"Why, I've known Jonathan for years," he said. "Who would have thought he could do something like this? I'm just glad you're all right, Mr. Secretary General,"
Chaim Rosenzweig said. "Well, I am not all right," Carpathia said. "And I will not be all right for a long time. These were my friends." And that's how it went, all around the room. Buck's body felt like lead, knowing Carpathia would eventually get to him and that he was the only one in the room not under Nikolai's hypnotic power.
But what if Buck said so?
Would he be killed next?
Of course he would.
He had to be.
Could he lie?
Should he?
He prayed desperately as Carpathia moved from man to man, making certain they had all seen what he wanted them to see and that they were sincerely convinced of it.
Silence, God seemed to impress upon Buck's heart. Not a word.
Buck was so grateful to feel the presence of God in the midst of this evil and mayhem that he was moved to tears. When Carpathia got to him, Buck's cheeks were wet and he couldn't speak. He shook his head and held up a hand. Awful, was it not, Cameron? The suicide that took Mr. Todd Cothran with it. Buck could not speak and wouldn't have if he could.
You cared for and respected them both, Cameron, because you were unaware that they tried to have you killed in London.
And Carpathia moved on to the guard.
Why could you not keep him from taking your gun, Scott?
The old man had risen.
It happened so fast. I knew who he was, an important rich man, and when he hurried over to me, I didn't know what he wanted. He ripped that gun right out of my holster, and before I could react, he had shot himself.
Yes, yes, Carpathia said as security rushed into the room. Everyone talked at once as Carpathia retreated to a corner, sobbing over the loss of his friends. A plainclothesman asked questions. Buck headed him off.
You have enough eyewitnesses here. Let me leave you my card and you can call if you need me, hm?
The cop traded cards with him, and Buck was permitted to leave. Buck grabbed his bag and sprinted for a cab, rushing back to the office. He shut and locked his office door and began furiously banging out every detail of the story. He had produced several pages when he received a call from Stanton Bailey. The old man could hardly catch his breath between his demanding questions, not allowing Buck to answer.
Where have you been? Why weren't you at the press conference? Were you in there when Stonegal offed himself and took the Brit with him? You should have been here. There's prestige for us having you in there. How are you going to convince anybody you were in there when you didn't show up for the press conference? Cameron, what's the deal?
I hurried back here to get the story into the system.
Don't you have an exclusive with Carpathia now?
Buck had forgotten that, and Plank hadn't reconfirmed it. What was he supposed to do about that? He prayed, but sensed no leading. How he needed to talk to Bruce or Chloe or even Captain Steele.
I'll call Steve and see, he said.
Buck knew he couldn't wait long to make the call, but he was desperate to know what to do. Should he allow himself to be in a room alone with Carpathia? And if he did, should he pretend to be under his mind control as everyone else seemed to be? If he hadn't seen this for himself, he wouldn't have believed it. Would he always be able to resist the influence with God's help? He didn't know. He dialed Steve's pager, and the call was returned a couple of minutes later.
Really busy here, Buck. What's up?
I was wondering if I've still got that exclusive with Carpathia.
You're kidding, right? You heard what happened here, and you want an exclusive?
Heard I was there, Steve.
Well, if you were here, then you probably know what happened before the press conference.
Steve, I saw it with my own eyes.
You're not following me, Buck. I'm saying if you were here for the press conference, you heard about the Stonegal suicide in the preliminary meeting, the one you were supposed to come to.
Buck didn't know what to say.
You saw me there, Steve. I didn't even see you at the press conference.
I wasn't at the press conference, Steve, but I was in the room when Stonegal and Todd Cothran died.
I don't have time for this, Buck. It's not funny. You were supposed to be there. You weren't there. I resent it. Carpathia is offended, and no exclusive.
I have credentials. I got them downstairs.
Then why didn't you use them?
I did. Steve hung up on him. Marge buzzed and said the boss was on the line again.
What's the deal with you not even going to that meeting? Bailey said.
I was there. You saw me go in.
Yeah, I saw you, You were that close. What did you do? Find something more important to do? You got some fast talking to do, Cameron.
I'm telling you, I was there. I'll show you my credentials.
I just checked the credential list, and you're not on it.
Of course I'm on it. I'll show them to you.
Your name's there, I'm saying, but it's not checked off.
Mr. Bailey, I'm looking at my credentials right now. They're in my hand.
Your credentials don't mean dirt if you didn't use them, Cameron. Now, where are you?
Read my story, Buck said. You'll know exactly where I was.
I just talked to 3-4 people who were there, including a UN guard and Carpathia's personal assistant, not to mention Plank. None of them saw you. You weren't there.
A cop saw me. We traded cards.
I'm coming back to the office, Williams. If you're not there when I get there, you're fired.
I'll be here.
Buck dug out the cop's card and called the number.
Precinct station, a voice said.
Buck read off the card.
Detective Sergeant Billy Senny, please.
What's the name again?
Senny, or maybe it's a hard C.
Kenny?
Don't recognize it. You got the right precinct?
Buck repeated the number from the card.
That's our number, but that ain't our guy.
How would I locate him?
I'm busy here, pal. Call Midtown.
It's important. Do you have a department directory?
Listen, we got thousands of cops.
Just look up C-E-N-N-I for me, will you?
Just a minute.
Soon he was back on.
Nothing, okay?
Could he be new?
He could be your sister, for all I know.
Where do I call? He gave Buck the number for police headquarters. Buck ran through the whole conversation again, but this time he had reached a pleasant young woman.
Let me check one more thing for you, she said. I'll get personnel on the line, because they won't tell you anything unless you're a uniformed officer anyway.
He listened as she spelled the name for personnel.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh, she said. Thank you, I'll tell him.
And she came back to Buck.
Sir, personnel says there is nobody in the New York Police Department named Senny, and there never has been. If somebody's got a phony police business card dolled up, they'd like to see it.
All Buck could do now was try to convince Stanton Bailey. Rayford Steele, Chloe, and Bruce Barnes watched the UN press conference, straining to see Buck.
Where is he?
Chloe said.
He has to be there somewhere. Everybody else from that meeting is there. Who's the girl?
Rayford stood when he saw her and silently pointed at the screen.
Dad, Chloe said. You're not thinking what I'm thinking.
It sure looks like her, Rayford said.
Shh, Bruce said. He's introducing everybody.
And my new personal assistant, having given up a career in the aviation industry,
Rayford flopped into a chair.
I hope Buck wasn't behind that.
Me too, Bruce said. That would mean he could have been sucked in too.
The news of the Stonegal suicide and Todd Cawthron's accidental death stunned them.
Maybe Buck took my advice and didn't go, Bruce said. I sure hope so.
That doesn't sound like him, Chloe said.
No, it doesn't, Rayford said. I know, Bruce said, but I can hope. I don't want to find out that he's met with foul play. Who knows what happened in there, and him going in with only our prayers?
I'd like to think that would be enough, Chloe said.
No, Bruce said. He needed the covering of God himself.
By the time Stanton Bailey stormed into Buck's office an hour later, Buck realized he was up against a force with which he could not compete. The record of his having been at that meeting had been erased, including from the minds of everyone in the room. He knew Steve wasn't faking it. He honestly believed Buck had not been there. The power Carpathia held over those people knew no limits. If Buck had needed any proof that his own faith was real and that God was now in his life, he had it. Had he not received Christ before entering that room, he was convinced he would be just another of Carpathia's puppets. Bailey was not in a discussing mood,
So Buck let the old man talk, not trying to defend himself.
I don't want any more of this nonsense about your having been there. I know you were in the building and I see your credentials, but you know and I know and everybody who was in there knows that you weren't. I don't know what you thought was more important, but you were wrong. This is unacceptable and unforgivable, Cameron. I can't have you as my executive editor.
I'll gladly go back to senior writer, Buck said.
Can't go along with that either, pal. I want you out of New York. I'm going to put you in the Chicago Bureau.
I'll be happy to run that for you.
Bailey shook his head. You don't get it, do you, Cameron? I don't trust you. I should fire you. But I know you'd just wind up with somebody else.
I don't want to be with anybody else.
Good, because if you tried to jump to the competition, I'd have to tell them about this stunt. You're going to be a staff writer out of Chicago, working for the woman who was Lucinda's assistant there. I'm calling her today to give her the news. It'll mean a whopping cut in pay, especially considering what you would have gotten with the promotion. You take a few days off, get your things in order here, get that apartment sublet, and find yourself a place in Chicago. Someday I want you to come clean with me, son. That was the sorriest excuse for news gathering I've ever seen, and by one of the best in the business.
Mr. Bailey slammed the door. Buck couldn't wait to talk to his friends in Illinois, but he didn't want to call from his office or his apartment, and he didn't know for sure whether his cellular phone was safe. He packed his stuff and took a cab to the airport, asking the cabbie to stop at a payphone a mile outside the terminal. Not getting an answer at the Steeles, he dialed the church. Bruce answered and told him Chloe and Rayford were there.
"Put them on the speakerphone," he said. "I'm taking the 3 o'clock American flight to O'Hare. But let me tell you this, Carpathia is your man, no question. He fills the bill to the last detail. I felt your prayers in the meeting. God protected me. I'm moving to Chicago and I want to be a member of, what did you call it, Bruce? The Tribulation Force? That's it.
Does this mean..." Chloe began.
"You know exactly what it means," Buck said. "Count me in."
"What happened, Buck?" Chloe asked.
"I'd rather tell you about it in person," he said. "But have I got a story for you. And you're the only people I know who are going to believe it."
When his plane finally touched down, Buck hurried up the jetway and through the gate where he was joyously greeted by Chloe, Bruce, and Rayford Steele. They all embraced him, even the staid captain. As they huddled in a corner, Bruce prayed, thanking God for their new brother and for protecting him. They moved through the terminal toward the parking garage, striding four abreast, arms around each other's shoulders, knit with a common purpose. Rayford Steele, Chloe Steele, Buck Williams, and Bruce Barnes faced the gravest dangers anyone could face, and they knew their mission. The task of the Tribulation Force was clear, and their goal nothing less than to stand and fight the enemies of God during the 7 most chaotic years the planet would ever see.
The End. You've been listening to Left Behind by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, narrated by Richard Ferrone. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.